hosted by LSE Human Rights and LSE Sociology. My name is Monica Kraus. I'm a professor of sociology here at the LSE, and I'm really pleased to welcome and introduce our speaker today, Professor Poulami Roychaudhuri. She's an associate professor of sociology at McGill University in Montreal, and she is the author of Capable Women in Capable States, which was published by Oxford in 2021. This is one of the books that has won pretty much all the awards that it was eligible for. I will mention just one, which is the award for the best book awarded by the Human Rights section of the American Sociological Association. It's a fantastic book, and if you haven't had a chance to look at it, I really recommend you read it. Professor Roychaudhuri will speak for about 45 minutes, and then there will be time for questions and discussions. I should say that it might be that this is recorded, so please turn your phone off and keep that in mind. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm already messing up this. So one of my students is here, and they know that I move around constantly. I'm sorry, I can't. So if at any point you can't hear me, just, you know, let me know, like I'm moving around too much. Monica, thank you so much for organizing this talk and for that lovely introduction. So today, you know, what I want to talk to you about is something conceptual about human rights that I've been thinking through, about with two case studies to think through these questions that I've been mulling over, which really has to do with what, you can hear me, right? All of you? Yeah, it's good? Okay. Really has to do with what I would say are irregularities in rights. What do I mean by this? Well, first, when we think about human rights, right, they are unevenly distributed, territorially speaking. So an example of this is the right to due process. You have it in certain countries, you don't have it in others. Another irregularity is that rights are often unconventional. So you have a right that supposedly, you know, is part of the law in the place that you live in, but it defies established social norms and relations. A good example of this is, I was born in India, right? So technically speaking, boys and girls have equal rights to paternal property, according to the Hindu Succession Act in India. Nobody believes that boys and girls have equal rights to paternal property, including girls themselves. So this is an example of a right that is completely unconventional, and therefore most women do not get equal rights, if any, to the property of their parents when they pass away. Third, another irregularity, and you know, this is not a comprehensive list, these are the three that I've been thinking about in my work. Another irregularity is the fact that, you know, you can have rights on paper, but they're completely, like they're so mired in bureaucracy that it's impossible to attain them in practice. A good example of this is, I grew up in the US, and if you want to access welfare, so currently if you're a single mother with a, you know, with children, you can apply for TAMF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. But because this is a means-tested program, it's very difficult to actually prove that, you know, you qualify, even though you do. So this is an example of how technically you're guaranteed this right, but it can be so difficult to overcome the bureaucracy that it becomes unattainable. So given these three irregularities that we see in different places with different kinds of rights, the questions I want to think through today are, so two questions. How do these irregularities shape how rights are claimed? And two, how do they impact how rights are governed? So the first question for me has to do with ordinary people, how we go about making rights claims. And the second question has to do with law enforcement personnel and state officials. What do they do when they are actually the ones who are embedded in this kind of market? So the two case studies I'm gonna talk through with you today, is the first comes from my work in India on domestic violence. And here, really, the situation that we're dealing with is that India has both criminal and civil rights against domestic violence for women, right? But in practice, it's almost impossible to access these rights. The second case is my new work on abortion in the US, and some of you may know that what's happened since last summer is that abortion is no longer legal in all parts of the US. And so the situation we're seeing here is, you know, if the status of domestic violence law in India is that it's pretty unattainable because of bureaucratic hurdles, in the US we're seeing a very uneven geography of rights. So let me first talk through some of the conventional ways of thinking through the questions I'm posing, right? Well, given that rights are unattainable, how are claims made? How are rights governed? And you know, a lot of the way that, especially when we're thinking about questions about women's rights, a lot of the way that existing literature thinks through these questions is by focusing just on law enforcement personnel. They say that, hey, these are the people in control of this process, right? So when we think about how the rights process happens, we need to think about these actors and who they select and what kinds of mechanisms they use to make the selection. So domestic violence, right? So one of the very common ways of thinking through, okay, who accesses rights? Oh, well, it's women who are good victims. You may have encountered this in your work, and it's compelling. It's a compelling narrative, right? So that if you have experienced some kind of gender-based violence, what happens to you is that you go to a police officer, and the police officer is like, well, were you wearing tight clothes or something, you know, like, oh, you were, so you're not a good victim. Okay. So this is the way to think about this. And work on abortion in the American context also talks a good deal about how a prosecution is selective, right? So prosecutors have exercised a lot of discretion, and the people that they actually pick out when there's, you know, like, oh, you had an illegal abortion, right? That process is all about the law enforcement personnel. So I'm going to use a slightly alternative approach to think through these questions. I think this approach has merit, but I think there's other things going on when we think about how irregularities in rights impacts what people do in order to get rights and how state officials actually respond. And I don't think the story is just about what's going on within criminal justice institutions. Okay, so the alternate approach I'm building on really comes from the anthropology of the state, as well as work on in political sociology. So three ideas here that I think are interesting to consider. One, we know that if you folks are scholars of human rights and law, we know that there's a liminal distinction often between state law, state violence, and non-state authority. And part of the reason is that states actually, you know, they don't always control what's going on, right? So sovereignty can be dispersed. The state sometimes have limited capacities, and this leads to all sorts of negotiations. So we see in certain contexts, states not enforcing immigration laws because they're like, it's like, we can't really do this, so we're going to do something else, right? So so there's often non-enforcement, outsourcing of regulation. And partly the reason that state officials do this is because ordinary people, when they make rights claims, especially in contexts where they know that those rights are inaccessible, use all sorts of tactics, including illegal ones, via what Partha Chatterjee, if you're familiar with his work, has termed political society. So I'm going to build off of this tradition to think through these questions of rights claims and governance, because what I'm going to argue to you is that irregularities actually lead to things that we may not be expecting. And what's happening is not bound within the offices of the state. Okay, so first case study. So this is the book that Monica told you about. This is my latest book on domestic violence. So, you know, if you want to read more, I'm going to really skim through some of the findings, right? So if you want to read more, this has been published through Oxford University Press. So the key things you need to know about domestic violence in India are about 31% of women between the ages of 15 to 45 say they have experienced some sort of violence, right? This is actually comparable to places like the UK and the US. India has two key laws. One is a criminal statute, section 498A of the Indian Penal Code. This provides imprisonment and fines if violence is proven in court. It also has a civil law, which was passed in 2005, the Protection of Women from Domestic Violence Act, PWDVA for short. This provides civil orders of protection, alimony, residential rights, et cetera. Right? Okay. Main problem with these laws, they are almost impossible to get, right? So section 498A routinely has the lowest conviction rate of any crime prosecuted under the Indian Penal Code. By the way, like, they're not even doing very good on murder, so it's really a feat to be the lowest, right? Like, lowest conviction rate, repeatedly. This is a criminal law, so technically, once you file a case, you are not supposed to withdraw the case. That is illegal. But this routinely happens. Even judges encourage women to, oh, you know, why don't you just, like, go settle this outside of court? That's totally illegal, but it happens. 6% of cases officially, but it's unofficially, it's much higher. The main problem with the Civil Act is that, you know, this is a country of 500 million women, like, you know, whatever. So, like, you do 30% of that. 446 cases registered countrywide, right? So almost nobody is even able to or knows about the law, like, is registering the case. Okay, so rights are unattainable. This picture summarizes why, partly why, okay? So look at the man's expression, look at all the stuff behind him. Okay, so this is a picture of a high court record room in Patna, Bihar. And one of the main reasons that domestic violence rights are unattainable in this context has to do with the institution through which rights are governed. So this is an institution that is manned. It is almost all men, right? So I use that term very, it is manned by men, right? And they are very expressively hostile towards domestic violence survivors, not towards rape survivors, interestingly, right? But when a woman says that she has suffered domestic violence, police officers, judges see her as a homebreaker. And it's a very unique way, and it's, you know, it's not pertinent to other forms of gender-based violence, necessarily, right? So they don't want to help these women. The other thing is that they're not super capable of helping these women. So the files that you see behind, those are you know, like, active court cases. And you can probably tell that much of the paper is yellow because they've been sitting there for such a long time, right? So this is an extremely overburdened institution. 28.5 million pending cases in India's district courts. That is the level of with which this, you know, institution is overburdened. India has one of the lowest police to civilian ratios in the world. The police are obviously the people who register criminal cases, right? One of the lowest police to, it's one in 503, the average, but in the places where I was working, it was actually closer to one to 1,000 civilians per police officer. Together, this means that the people who are supposed to be helping you claim rights, neither really want to help you, nor are they super able to, right? So rights become very unattainable. Okay, given this context, what did I do? Right, okay, if you're interested in methods, I can also give you more about my sample later. Right, but okay, so I did a little over 2 years of ethnography where I tracked 70 women. The 70 women, it was a very diverse group. This is intentionally the case, right? Because a lot of the existing literature says that the main, you know, like the main sort of mechanisms through which women are able to access rights or not has to do with their social background, right? So the 70 women varied by religion, by income, by caste, and by residential location, if they lived in a rural or urban location. These are some of the key ways in which privilege is structured within this context, right? So if you're an upper class Hindu Brahmin woman who lives in Delhi, you are far more privileged than any of the other, like, right? Like a Muslim poor woman who lives in a village, right? So, okay. So I tracked 70 women who alleged that they had suffered some sort of domestic violence. I also interviewed law enforcement personnel and brokers, people who mediated between women and the state. And the interview data actually collected data from before and after the ethnography, so over 16 years of data through the interviews. The ethnography was based in my home state of West Bengal. Okay, so back to the questions. Given that rights are there on paper, but pretty much unattainable in practice, how do survivors actually claim rights? Well, what I found was that they were not following legal procedure at all, nor were they trying to be a good victim so that the police or the protection officer would entitle them through the law. That's not what was happening. They were doing something very, very different, which I term performing capability. And capability is a term that they actually use themselves, right? They say, like, I have kamota, I have jogota, these are Bengali terms for capability. So first, this involved, they would mobilize organized help, right? So they would approach a women's group, they would approach political parties, they would approach sometimes criminals, and they would use these groups to physically, verbally threaten both abusers and law enforcement personnel. And along with these threats, where, you know, you take your women's group, you camp out in a police station until the police officer actually does what you want them to because you're disturbing their, like, daily routine, right? They also did something else, which is that they negotiated compromises. So they would say, okay, like, you don't have to register this case, just, like, help me do X, right? Okay, what were law enforcement personnel doing? They were also completely ignoring the law. Like, they were doing nothing that had to do with what they were supposed to be doing. Instead, they were incorporating women with organized resources. And what I mean by this is that they were delegating social control to these women. They were saying, oh, okay, yeah, you have been here all day and you're really bothering me, and you're also, like, calling the political party who is in complete control of, you know, my job. So let's do this. We will register a case, but you do my work for me. Like, you go and fill out these documents and get your women's NGO or get your, like, local political, you know, party cadre member to help you round up witnesses. Or, so we register this case, but I reassign casework. Or, you know what, like, why do you need a case? Let's just, you know, do something totally outside of the law, right? So they also promoted what I call parallel claims, where they would say, let's not bother registering anything, but one of my guys will accompany you while you just go and grab your stuff. If you want to beat up your abuser with your new friends, that's fine. You know, like, so this is what's happening, right? Okay, so an example of this. This young woman I met, right? So she first approached her local police station, the Thana, with her parents, completely ignored. So then she came back, she then approached a women's group with 19,000 members in this area. The women's group accompanies her, one of the caseworkers, along with five women from the group. They accompany her to the station. Things go very differently because the police station knows the women's group, right? And the police officer's like, well, we're really busy because it's election season and we have to man the polling, you know, like I don't really have that many resources right now, so, okay, but you have, you know, like, your, like, helpers here, so why don't you go and go get your kids back, go get your jewelry back, whatever you want. I'll send one of my constables. He'll watch from a tree nearby. So we all go, and she enters her husband's home, right? There's like some like threats, like someone hits him. Okay, the police officer is like watching from the tree. The chickens get out of a coop and like they fly into a pond, and the police officer is like, oh, like gets wet, wades into the pond, grabs the chickens. Everyone's like, haha, this is amazing. This is a great resolution to this thing, right? So they all go home, the police officer's wet, the women are like feeling really empowered. She has chickens, which may or may not be hers. I don't know, you know, like she also has some stuff, which may or may not be hers. She has regained custody of her children. Okay, this is an example of what's actually going on. No case was registered. But technically, this woman is guaranteed her possessions. I don't know if those were her possessions, to be honest with you, but she's guaranteed something, right? So she's gotten something out of this process. She's gotten her children back. So as you can tell, the net sum of what's going on the ground is not a legal outcome. So 78%, so I told you, I gathered data for 16 years, actually, even though I wasn't there. But after 16 years, 78% of the cases that had actually been registered were still pending. This is not an anomaly. If you look at the aggregate numbers, it's a 498A case takes 10 to 15 years to have some kind of resolution. So not very much going on in terms of legal outcomes, but a lot going on in terms of extra legal outcomes. So these numbers are not going to add up to 100, by the way, right? Because the same woman might have gotten multiple things. So by doing the kinds of negotiations that I just described to you, 27% of these women were able to temporarily at least stop the violence they were experiencing. Another 31% got some sort of informal financial settlement, right? Not through the law, but the husband's like, okay, I'll give you 10,000 rupees to leave me alone. Right? And then the women's organization or the political party sits there and watches the transaction happen. So immense amount of extra legality. To come back to the questions I posed in the beginning of the talk, how are rights claimed and how are rights governed in a context where really they are unattainable, even though they are available on paper? Well, the main thing I want you to take away from this is that both the way that claims happen and that the state itself is governing has very little to do with the law. Both state officials and women are using immense amounts of illegality to claim legal rights. They're not actually ending up claiming legal rights. They're ending up getting extra legal things that mirror the law. So that the main managerial technique for unattainability is illegality in this context. So both the performance of capability by survivors involves things like threats, physical violence, bribery. None of this is legal. Similarly, the delegation of social control by law enforcement is also not a legal practice, right? Okay, now I'm gonna switch, supposedly. How am I doing on time?
20 minutes.
Oh, really? Okay, I have plenty of time. Okay. More time for discussion. Okay, so I'm going to switch contexts and move to my current work on abortion in the United States. So, you know, my thoughts on this are much more nascent because I'm in the process of gathering data. So I might tell you next year that I was wrong at this point. I don't think so, but so I'm gonna give you my initial ideas. So fetal personhood and the politics of abortion. June of last summer, the Supreme Court of the United States says that the landmark legislation, Roe versus Wade, 1973, which gave women all across the US the right to have an abortion, is null and void. And now the Supreme Court turns over abortion rights to individual states. It says that it's up to the state to decide, right? Okay, so this is the result of the Supreme Court decision. This is a map from the Center for Reproductive Rights. The maroon states are states where abortion is already illegal, like at all times. The red states are hostile and in the process of making it illegal. The yellow states, technically it's like abortion is protected in these states either by statutory law or by the state constitution, but what you need to know is that even in many of these states, it's like protected to such a degree that it's impossible, right? So like Florida, for example, 15 weeks. You can get an abortion until 15 weeks. This is a yellow state where technically, but like many people don't even know that they are pregnant at 15 weeks, right? So really the only places where you can really get an abortion right now in the US are the blue states. Not very many states. So what does this mean, given that the new landscape of abortion rights in the United States is this kind of unevenness, right? What's happening? How are women actually accessing abortion services? Well, many of them aren't, right? So I can give you numbers. We don't know the aggregate numbers for the, you know, like the last few months, but I can give you the numbers for the first 2 months after the Dobbs decision. So in just those 2 months, there were 10,670 fewer abortions in the US in those 2 months than the average for those months in the prior years. Okay, so this tells you that one way to answer this question is that they're not accessing abortion services, right? But one thing that complicates our ability to actually answer this question accurately is that the number of illegal abortions has skyrocketed. So we do not know, actually, if it was 10,600. Does that make sense, right? Because out of fear of criminalization, a lot of women are not reporting that they are having abortions. So they're doing one of two things. One is that they are crossing state borders if they have the resources to do so. Not everyone does, and as you can imagine, if you are like here in Arkansas or something, you're going to have to cross many, many state borders to get to a place, right? So this is not a solution for most women. So some are crossing. Crossing state borders is already illegal in certain states. So you are not allowed to go to another state. In other states, lawmakers are introducing all sorts of bills saying things like, you are kidnapping the child inside of you by crossing the state border, right? And then doing something illegal to it, so then you will be prosecuted for it. So these are the kinds of laws that are now actually being thought through in these contexts, right? The notion that fetal personhood, right? That there is a person inside of you and that you are kidnapping them by, you the pregnant woman, by taking them across state borders. Some women are crossing, but it's difficult to do so. You need money, you need a car, et cetera, right? The main thing that women are doing is they are undertaking self-managed abortions through abortion pills. So the picture you see here is the abortion pill is a combination of drugs, of misoprostol and mifepristone. These pills are also not available in these states now because they are illegal as well. But what women are increasingly doing is there are organizations that are based in states where these pills are legal and organizations that are based outside of the US completely in places like Mexico, in Denmark, who have an internet presence or there's a telephone number that you can call. So you get in touch with this organization. They then largely get these pills from India, which is one of the world's largest producers of cheap abortion pills. The pills then get shipped to the US, and it gets shipped to someone in a state where abortion is legal. Then that person mails the pill or hand delivers it, all under the, you know, like if it's being mailed, it's being mailed in a box with chocolates or something, right? So like you don't know what's actually coming through the mail. And it gets to the woman who needs it, right? So this is now one of the key ways in which abortion services are being accessed in these states. One of the good things about this is that the abortion pill does have a very, very high success rate, but it's still not a possibility for a lot of women, and it's self-managed, right? You're doing it yourself. Okay, so, but the net sum of what I'm trying to tell you is that the answer to the question of, okay, how are abortion seekers actually navigating this new uneven landscape of abortion rights? Through illegality, basically, right? They're doing all sorts of illegal things. Now, what about the second question of how state officials are governing this new context? Well, you know, some are clamping down, right? Like they're very eager. A lot of the states where abortion is no longer legal have lawmakers that are very, very anti-abortion. But interestingly, a lot of people have come forward and said they're just like not going to enforce these laws. So this, what you're looking at, is a joint statement signed by, I want to give you the right number. Is it 88? Or is it 80? Yeah, 88. Okay, so 88 district attorneys. District attorneys in the US are literally the representative of the state in criminal proceedings. These people are coming forward and saying, we will not do what we are supposed to be doing, and we are signing this very public declaration saying that we are going to completely ignore this law in the jurisdiction that we have control over, right? Some of these people have already been fired, especially in Florida. But this is an example of law enforcement personnel, state officials, using blatantly illegal tactics to, you know, sort of manage this new unevenness that they are facing. So again, you know, what we seem to be witnessing in the US right now, interestingly, is a turn towards illegality by both ordinary citizens and by state officials in response to this new landscape. So, you know, I want to conclude by talking through some of the implications of my talk. I've titled my talk Irregular Rights, right? And I put that in quotes because what I mean by this is that irregularity in the form of unevenness, of unattainability, and of unconventionality, which I haven't talked about through case studies, it's actually a regular feature of rights. Rights are irregular, right? This means a couple of things. It means that irregularity isn't specific to certain kinds of rights. It's just something that plagues a domestic violence law. That's not what I'm saying. It also means, I think, you know, given that you're at LSE, you probably are not approaching rights in this way, but there is a popular way of thinking of rights that thinks about the irregularities that I've pointed to as something that is a condition of the global South, right? Like, oh, this is like a post-colonial issue or something, and we just need to, so this is a kind of a dominant framework in certain kinds of political science where it's like, okay, we need to get rid of the irregularities because in other places, rights are irregular. That's also not what I'm saying, right? So the case of the US and the India, I have chosen very specifically to talk about how irregularities are not just a post-colonial problem, it's also something that we see in post-welfare states. So given that what I'm saying is that rights are irregular, the second thing that I would like you to take away from this talk is the idea that if rights are irregular, the way that irregularity is managed by both civilians and state officials is through illegality. An example of this is that because rights are not evenly distributed across all, we do see, for example, the illegal quote-unquote movement of undocumented people, right? This is an endemic feature of a world where in certain places you just don't have access to the same kinds of rights. It will create movement. And what I find fascinating about the work that I've been doing is that this is not something, illegality is not something that just civilians are utilizing. It's also state officials are which I think is really quite interesting. So the last point that I'll leave you with is the fact that, one, rights are irregular, two, how is irregularity managed through illegality? I think what's fascinating is that illegality in both of these cases actually has justice-enhancing effects. And what do I mean by that? Well, if survivors in West Bengal were just like, I'm just gonna go and not threaten the cops, they would actually get less. They would get nothing, right? So in the end, the fact that they're deploying all sorts of illegal tactics makes them better off. And to me, that is a justice enhancing. It depends on your politics, right? But I'm like, this is a good thing. At least, she did get some ducks, you know? I don't know if they're hers, but she's really poor, so that's good. And this reminds me of something, if you're familiar with the work of Judith Schlar. She wrote about legalism a long time ago, and she talked about how there isn't a pure dichotomy between the law and politics, right? That, in fact, these things work together. And the law is constituted. So when we think about what is the law, right? One of the things that come out of my talk, I think, is the idea that the law is constituted by varying degrees of legalistic acts, right? So it's it's a range. And what's fascinating about the possibility that illegality might have justice-enhancing effects in both of these contexts, both for abortion seekers in the US and for domestic violence survivors in India, is the fact that not all acts that resist state regulation necessarily lead to chaos, right? That they actually may be creating a less chaotic situation by giving people access to things that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. So all in all, what I hope you take away from this talk is the possibility that we need to think, and this is what I've been trying to think through, is that we need to think about illegality differently. Not as something that is opposed to human rights, or as something that needs to be stamped out in order for, states to get down to business and ensure rule of law, right? Which I think is a popular way to think about illegal practices, but as something that is of strategic value for expanding rights, helping people access things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to access, that they really need, and interestingly also providing state officials stopgap solutions in contexts where they may be overburdened and where many of their colleagues may not actually, want to help, right? But that it provides some kind of slightly better solution, right, for everyone involved. And so I'm going to end there, and I would be happy to answer your questions, and also Monica's.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Let's have some questions. I would like to invite, I propose we take a couple of questions, and then you perhaps can respond to each and all, and also some of the themes that might cut across the question.
Yeah, that's good.
And if you don't mind, if you could say briefly your name and where you're from, or if you're at the LSE, what program you're affiliated with, that would be great. Yes, in the white shirt and then in the last row. Thank you.
Hi. Hi, I'm Nicole. I'm from the U.S. I'm from Pennsylvania. And I'm a master's student in our gender department here. I was curious in your research at all in the U.S. context, and thank you again for sharing everything that you've thought about. If you've considered SB8, which is the Texas very specific ban that came out September 2021, has a really unique element in it regarding vigilantism. So citizens, I think that a really interesting question came up where if you're doing that illegal rights work of accessing services, but then at the same time other civilians believe it is their right to be pursuing you, like both of those actors feel justified given the discussion that we've had today. And I think it's a really strange loop. So I was just curious if you've thought about that very specific example in the context of illegality, and whether or not we can make any sense of that. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to take the question in the last row, just so we can think about issues together.
Hi, my name is Radhika, and I'm from India, particularly from Patna. So that slide where you pointed out Patna, Bihar, I was going through things. So I really liked your point of illegality can have justice-enhancing effects. And just like looking through it, I want to question, can we institutionalize that, or what risks does institutionalizing that then pose, particularly for marginalized communities, in the fact that this may be the only way recourse for them to get some justice? Thank you.
And let's have this question as well. Yes, in the last row.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. I'm Sachi, I'm from New Delhi, so also experienced a lot of what you talked about firsthand. I'm in the Human Rights and Politics Masters here at LSE, and I have in the past worked with survivors of domestic and sexual violence, especially queer survivors of violence in India, especially when it was actually criminalized, like a lot of queer activities were criminalized in India. And I was just wondering how your concept of like performance capability would look like for instances of, say, survivors of marital rape where they can't ever access law because it is not criminalized yet. Or, for example, in the erstwhile case of Section 377, which criminalized homosexuality. So how would queer survivors of domestic or sexual violence access, like when they can't access law in any way, how does performance capability change, if at all?
Will you say that last part one more time? I just couldn't hear it.
Yes, like if you cannot access law because law does not criminalize the violence that you experience, then how does your experience of performance capability change, if at all?
Yeah.
Answer some of these.
That would be great. These are such great questions. I felt like the two of you had a lot of overlap in the questions you were asking about. So let me actually start with your question and remind me of your name.
Sachi.
So this is a great question, right? So like, you're right that the criminal law rape in India, like it excludes all sorts of things, right? So it's completely like, if you're a trans woman, you're not gonna be covered, right? Like if you're a gay man, you're right. So it's like, it's very specific to cis women who have been raped by not by their husbands. Like, this is a country that still does not recognize marital rape. So one thing that has happened with the Civil Act is that the Civil Act recognizes sexual abuse, So in answer to your question, one of the interesting things that happens when in a place where marital rape is not an offense, but sexual abuse is within marriage, is that women tend to narrate sexual violence through the language of abnormal acts. Does that make sense? So they cannot say that, oh, my husband raped me by having sex with me in, you know, like vaginal sex with me last night, because he can do that, right? That's his prerogative. But they can go and say, and they do, I don't know if this actually happened, but this is the only way to access anything, right? So what do you do in that context? You go and say, well, he's forced me to give him oral sex 5 times. Everyone thinks this is appalling, right? Like, no husband should be forcing his wife to give him oral sex 5 times a day. Not even once a day. Like, even that, like, the police officer's like, ooh, okay. Like, that's not okay, right? So this is one of the ways and which the absence of a certain kind of protection encourages a narration of something that may or may not be going on, right? But this is the only route. But I think there's another question that you're also asking, which is, look, yes, officially the law doesn't recognize marital rape, but this is also a context where the rapes of certain kinds of women are never, ever of concern to anyone, right? So my book ends with this extremely spectacular incident that happened in Nagpur a while ago, where for 10 years, this guy had been terrorizing this one slum. Like, he was like the slum lord, right? And he was extremely violent, and he used sexual violence as a method of like punishment, basically, for people who didn't pay up, right? And so the women in the slum had repeatedly for 10 years approached the police saying, hey, like, he is raping us, and he's mutilating us, like, help. Of course the police don't help because he's paying off the police, right? Okay, so what happens in 2004, this guy gets pulled into court on completely different charges, like for tax evasion or something. He probably pissed off the wrong politician, is what I understood. So he's in court, 100 women from the slum show up, they know that he's gonna be in an open courthouse that day. They show up to that courthouse in front of the cops, they drag him out of the witness box, they castrate him, they cut him hundreds of times and pour chili powder all over him. He dies bleeding on the ground. Nobody is intervening through this incident, right? So like the police are like, ugh, like 100 women with knives, like flee, because there's also like 2 cops, right? This is where the capacity problems of the police actually prevent them from, they're like, oh, let's go. Okay, so like 5 days later, the police are like, oh, we've gotten the ringleaders of these women who's like executed basically this man in an open courtroom. They they arrest 5 women out of 100. Within days, they're freed because the entire city is laid under siege by women's groups who were like, what the, you know, like, how dare you arrest these women? They have now started an NGO, which is, by the way, funded by Nicholas Kristof. So very, very interesting turn of events. But like half the sky, you know, like that. He never refers to this interesting background in his book. He's just like, oh, like women's empowerment. But this is the history of women's empowerment. So this is not just a, you know, this is not just a question about, hey, this is a country where marital rape isn't recognized. All sorts of rape are not, you know, like, recognized. So what happens? This is the extreme version of the capability that I'm describing. Like, where you go and you slaughter the guy who has been violently raping all of you for years in front of the cops. They can't do anything. They don't. And now you have an NGO that's awesome and, like, you know, like helping other women and girls. So, okay, I hope that addresses your question. So 2 things happening, actually, right? Massive amounts of public illegality, and then also sort of like an illegal narration of something that may not have happened in order to access what is available to you through this domestic abuse clause, right? Okay, now, to address both of your questions, So I guess my short answer to you is read my book, because I've only given you the rah-rah side of, you know, my book is also like, ends with a very dark, like, this is also very dangerous. You know, so like, so I'm, this talk is like, yay, justice enhancing effects. And my book is like, and now the Hindu nationalists in India are, right, like, using this very process to do all sorts of horrific things. So what can I tell you? Like, the Texas, I don't know what's going to happen, right? So like, I think it depends partly on how it's enforced, but I'm watching it closely. And yeah, I don't know. Like, so in both of these situations, the use of the kinds of tactics I've just described to you is not just about, it's not just, we shouldn't be just concerned that they are going to be used by people who are not survivors. It's also of concern when survivors use these tactics, at least in India, right? So an example of this is one of the last incidents I saw in my field work was a case where a Muslim man and a Hindu woman had gotten married without the consent, you know, like their families didn't approve of this relationship. A couple years down the line, I frankly don't know what's happening in this case, right? The woman says that the man has been abusing her. In the end, what happened was that her family called in the Hindu Nationalist Party, which is now gaining ground in West Bengal, and they beat him up, extra legal process, right? They beat up this Muslim man, broke his arm, he's poor, they like, you know, destroyed his house. Is this a justice enhancing effect? And that's where I end my, I'm like, I don't know what's happening here, right? But the same tactics are being used by somebody who says that she is a survivor. She may be. He might have been abusing her. But is there also something else happening? Yes. Is there an affirmation of, like, Hindu nationalism? Yes. Right? So I think the dangers are very real. And not just when, as in the Texas case, when the sort of, like, the delegation of the state is towards people who are anti-abortion. I hope that makes sense.
Hi, my name is Bariella. I'm originally from Albania, but I grew up in New York, and I'm in the human rights program here at LSC. And I was wondering, during your research process, particularly in India with cases of domestic violence, if you noticed that if there were gender relations existing when approaching the police, for example, if someone came with their father versus with a sister, how that affected the situation and whether police would listen to the survivor more, or there wasn't really a difference in the case. Thank you.
In the last round.
Hi, I'm Eloise. I'm from Scotland, and I'm on the political sociology master's. I was just wondering if you could speak a bit more about what the, like, women's organizations and NGOs in India, what their attitude is. I know you mentioned sometimes they've, like, helped people in these kind of extra legal processes. I'm just interested in what their work is surrounding this.
I think I didn't catch the last few words, but
just interested generally what their work is surrounding this and their attitude.
So we have a question about the role of gender when police is approached, and a question about women's NGOs in India. Could I add a question just also for information, since we're talking about human rights, what is the role, if any, of transnational discourses around human rights for the survivors in India? Do they use the notion of human rights as opposed to what the national law provides? What does it not feature? Mm-hmm. Symbolic stake.
Want me to answer those questions? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Um,
Okay, I'll go in order. So the main distinction I found in my work in terms of how police and protection officers, their responses varied, was not by the gender of the accompanying person. Does that make sense? So it didn't matter if a woman went with her father versus her mother. The main thing was, like, basically, even if you went with your mother, like, your father does, like, they will ignore you. Even if you are, you know, like, relatively well-to-do, they will ignore you. They will encourage you to do things like, oh, like, work it out, you know, like, it'll be okay, you know. The only time they won't ignore you is if you have some kind of large organization backing you. And that organization can be full of women. They just have to be large and able to actually do things like call in favors to political parties who appoint the police officer and also can transfer them to a really unsavory location they don't want to go to, right? So political parties, I think one of the interesting things in your question has to do with the organizations themselves, right? So the gendered nature of the organizations that women approach is very different. Women's groups, largely full of women, political parties, full of men. Was there a distinction in terms of if you show up with a political party versus a women's group, are they gonna be more favorable? No, it depended on if the political party was in power, right? So I did not see huge distinctions. It could be the case, I'm an ethnographer, right? So if you had a much larger sample, you might be able to get a finer gradient on the question. So I wanna just put that in there and say that, you know, I don't wanna be overconfident that doesn't matter. Okay, so then this question of the role of NGOs, which I think actually the person in front of you may know more about because they worked in this context, but so this is a place where women's organizing is, you know, has been very vibrant for a long time, and that matters, right? So this would not be happening, none of the stuff that I was telling you would be happening in India if there wasn't a huge presence of women's organizations who have been highly mobilized for years. And they've been very successful at actually putting the laws that are in place. It was them, right? So both the criminal and the civil statutes come out of women's organizations, feminist lawyers working together, right? So the Nagpur case I told you about, how the city gets immobilized. The city would not be immobilized if you didn't have women's organizations in this city, right? Rounding people up, saying, hey, we need to demonstrate against this. So this is a place where, especially in cities, but also in, let me show you, go back to this picture, but also in rural areas, you have a huge density of organizations. What am I looking for? Oh, here. So this picture, right? This is in Uttar Pradesh, in a very rural part of Uttar Pradesh, in Bundelkhand, where the woman you see sitting right there, Sabat Baldevi, she started an organization called the Gulabi Gang. Some of you may know of this organization because like she was later on like Indian Idol, like that's another story, but there's also a movie about this group, but she started this group in Bundelkhand because largely to address domestic violence, right? But they have like 400,000 members. So even in very rural areas, you see like the presence of these organizations helping women. And one of the things, interesting things that come out of this is a very variegated discourse of rights, to get to Monica's question. So Monica, I think you're asking, to what degree is the transnational discourse of rights pertinent for survivors themselves, right? And what I found is that it's not pertinent at all in the beginning. Like, nobody is walking around, like, and very few people know about these laws, right? Like, also, that's not how most people tend to, but this is not particular to the US, right? Like, so if any of you have worked in the domestic violence arena, it's just not how people sort of think of their experiences necessarily, right? So I've worked with domestic violence survivors in the US, and
usually you're coming to someone asking for help with a very complicated kind of situation, like, okay, like he did this and then I did that and then he did, and you're not necessarily thinking through that experience in the language of rights, right? But what I noticed in my work is that because the presence of brokers, right, all these like people and organizations was so crucial for women in India, they would learn this language over time, and many of them did actually start to see their experiences through that framework the more they encountered an organization that had a vested interest in encouraging them to think about their life through that language, if that makes any sense.
Do we have another round of questions? We have time for one more round of questions. Yes, thank you.
Hi, I'm Antonia. Thank you so much for your talk. It was very interesting. I was wondering what role legal pluralism plays in this whole debate and like the space between legal and illegal. Like, mm-hmm. I don't really know what the role it is in India, but I know in like Southeast Asia and Africa, it's like so many countries which have a very like legal plural system, so I'm just very curious.
Tell me more about, like, so in these contexts, like, tell me a little bit more about what motivates your question.
I was thinking in particular, like, the case of, like, Indonesia, mm-hmm. and how, especially women as well, who've experienced domestic violence, did, like, strategically use a certain route to go, and like are very well aware of like different justice mechanisms and sometimes made a strategic choice to not go with a like formal legal way but like maybe a traditional like quote unquote like traditional justice mechanisms, and whether that would be considered as like an illegal form because you have such an interesting notion of illegality. Yeah. I was wondering how that fits.
This is a great question in this context, right? So India actually, it recognizes arbitration, which in West Bengal and Bangladesh as well, is called shalishi. So arbitration doesn't happen in court, right? But it is a part of a formal legal system that leads to legally recognized outcomes. And it's beholden to procedural requirements, right? And it can't just be like Monica can't just be like, well, I'm gonna be here like overseeing this part, right? You have to like be a kind of a certified judge or something, like somebody who is ordained by the state to conduct this process. So that exists, but a lot of what is actually happening is not that. Does that make sense? So a lot of the women I encountered in the beginning would say things like, oh, I'm doing a shalishi. And I thought it was this formal process. And then I realized, no, actually, it's not, right? So the police would say, oh, we're running a shalishi for this woman. So once again, I assumed it was the formal shalishi. I go there, it's not. They're using the legal term for something that has nothing to do with what is officially recognized by the state. And I actually found that fascinating, that even on the ground, there was almost no recognition by both the state and women themselves about the line between the formal and the informal. It's constantly being deployed to actually refer to all sorts of things that are totally not documented and part of the procedural requirements of this process. That makes sense.
Hi, I'm Tamara, and I'm in the Human Rights Program. I've done some work in the U.S. with women who have experienced domestic violence, and I guess like my question is interested in this idea of like a more embodied process happening in these mediations, and how do you think this process and these like means of illegality or justice seeking means sort of differ from a more like bureaucratic system where I think within my experience has a lot of limitations in what it can do for a woman or what it can say about the situation. And so I guess maybe like, do you think there's a specific benefit to the sort of face-to-face process of mediation that happens more often?
That's a good question. You know, one of the, I think one of the takeaways from what I learned was that it's not clean at all, the division between what is a state process, right? So like, women are constantly doing both. So like, there is a police officer present, he's just at that tree over there, right? So you, it's not that it's a clean process outside the law. They are simultaneously using the threat of the law, like embodied by that police officer. And in fact, I don't know if they would be able to do what they do without that cop there, right? So it's actually an imbrication, like these things are imbricated constantly. So I did not find a clean separation between, oh, okay, I'm having a more embodied non-state process here. In fact, women are, they're like, I'm just gonna throw everything at this, right? And that's what seems to work. Like, we'll have a cop, like, we'll also use some illegality, we'll also have this women's group, and that seems to be the kind of magic formula. I think we need to maybe rethink the distinctions between, okay, this is like not mediated by the state and this is.
Lily.
Yeah.
I did my master's in gender and policy, and I actually wrote my dissertation on abortion in the U.S. And through my research, I was kind of looking also. I did just aside from this, what happened in Mexico, decriminalized it because of the grassroots program that they had that normalized the self-induced abortion. Kind of as this response to these rights that actually limit something that I almost kind of think of as bad laws. And so I'm almost wondering, what did your research show for moving forward with these self-induced abortions, which are technically illegal, but maybe from many perspectives shouldn't? I don't know how to exactly ask that, but it's just like, it's just a bad law.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. It's too early to tell, right, what's going to happen in the U.S. You're absolutely right. So the Mexican example, so talking about like this whole narrative of like, oh, the U.S. like exports human rights to other places. No, Mexico is one of the places where people in the U.S. are now learning a lot from. And in fact, this whole system of mail ordered, you know, like abortion, it's coming from Mexico. So one of the organizations was started in Mexico, and this organization now provides pills that are being smuggled over the Mexican-US border into the US. So the degree to which the future is rosy in the US in a similar, right? Like the, I don't know, like what, we're dealing with very different kinds of states, right? So, I don't know. We'll see.
We have a question here in the back, and then we have time for perhaps one or two more questions.
Hi, my name is Riley. I am from the United States, and I am in the Gender Policy and Inequality Master's Program. And I'm not exactly sure how to formulate this question, but in thinking about rights and groups that have been denied rights, there's this narrative that you can't not want them, but given the colonial foundation of human rights and the human rights corpus, do we still try to achieve those rights through legal or illegal avenues, mm-hmm. or do you see that as continuing to uphold those colonial ideals and there being perhaps another way outside of the human rights framework?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, I mean, I think there's also a lot of literature that talks about how rights are not colonial imports, that people in places like South Asia have been thinking about rights for a long time, right? And that, in fact, the framework of women's rights that we see in place today in the transnational sphere is led by a lot of women from the global south, right? So how can we answer that question of, are these colonial imports? Like, to me, like, I'm like, A, the language of rights is not something that was invented by the West, right? We have indigenous traditions of rights in other places, and that's important to remember. And two, like, this question of, like, should we move rights forward? I don't know, like, people in India seem to think that this is important for them, right? So who am I to say, I'd feel so uncomfortable being like, this is a colonial import, you shouldn't be doing this. Like, you know, like, clearly this, it matters. And I think in terms of my research, what I realized is when I think about the options available for an ordinary woman today in India versus women in my mother's generation and definitely in my grandmother's generation, I'm like, okay, things are like a lot better, right? Like, at least there is a law that you can go and do all these things around, right? So I was like, when my grandmother was my age, like, you couldn't even go to the cop and be like, my husband's beating you up, because you would just be like, well, there's no law that says that he can't, right? So it's better to have a law, even if it's unattainable, that you can say, hey, like, I do deserve this, right? Even if you're not gonna give it to me, at least I can get some stuff, right, on the side. So in that sense, I'm like, I don't know if I'm well placed to give people who seem to think that this is important for them that advice. And two, you know, I think there's a different way to think about rights, not as colonial inventions at all, but rather indigenous inventions. Maybe the term was different, but there's a lot of documentation that that's the case.
Hi, I'm Maddie. I'm an alum from the Gender and Policy Program here. I was just interested in the word legal and illegality. And obviously I know in this context that doesn't equate something that's bad, but I was just wondering if there's work being done around kind of the semantics and around what those words mean and reframing them or you know, I don't know, even different words to be used, just because the nuance of it is not bad, but yeah. You know, obviously when you hear, oh, abortion's illegal, they're doing illegal things,
yeah.
You know, that has connotations to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think, in a certain sense, I started with these terms, right? Like, oh, like, these are irregularities, to get to the idea that this is regular, right? And so I hope that by the end of the talk, but maybe not successfully and completely, that I was able to get to a place where the very terms illegality and legality are under question if we think about the law as a panoply of, you know, various kinds of acts, right? But I do think that analytically for me, as a sociologist, it's often useful to start with these terms. And if for no other reason that you can be prosecuted for certain things, right? They are illegal and it has consequences for people's lives. So.
I have been wondering where you end up on the old question of what is the law, what yeah. kind of thing is it? I think I often myself say it's a tool.
Yeah.
That's a metaphor, right? It makes me think of a hammer or, you just used a different image. Do you have an image of what you come out with on that question?
Yeah, you know, sometimes I'm like, it's a tool. And then sometimes I'm like, oh, it's a game, right? But the game idea is, I actually think deep down I'm a bit more optimistic about it that, you know, that it's not just a power play, right? Which is one way to think about the law. And because of my response to your question, right, which is that I do see that it has had positive effects for people. So would I say I come down on this side of, okay, this is all just like who's in power, and no, I don't think so. But I don't have a great answer for you. This is the question that everyone asks me, and I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I go back and forth a bit.
Hi, I'm Lulu. I'm a master's student here in the gender department. And I'd actually done quite a lot of research on domestic violence in Bihar for one of my policy classes, actually, and try and formulate some sort of policy to solve or to like kind of approach domestic violence in Bihar was a task in itself. Like, that was enormous. I don't even want to think of it, but it's too much PTSD. But anyway, I completely see the depth of your and the relevance of your research, and I was just also wondering, when you're drawing, I don't know if you're drawing a link between India's context and the US context, but even kind of going off of the question that was last asked, the kind of not only the nuances within the legal and illegal meanings, mm-hmm. but also within the social attitudes and how much that kind of drives what is considered legal and illegal, and also kind of how these manifested differently in India and the US, because they're completely different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we cannot even, it's difficult to draw those similarities between that. So I was just wondering, like, kind of, how did you navigate it? And if you made any kind of, approaching that, because it's a mammoth task in itself.
Yeah, and when you say approaching, like approaching the domestic violence context in India, or, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So to understand your question, like in terms of how I understood what what was going on, or
yeah, just kind of also what angle we're gonna take from it, because it's such a complex thing in itself, because there's so many things intertwining within it, and there's so many actors, and even it's not only geographically or even demographically rich, but there's so many other nuances in trying to tackle such, not a taboo, but kind of like a very sensitive topic.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of wanted to see your reflections on that.
Well, you know, interestingly, there's been a 10 percentage point drop in the rate of domestic violence since 2005. If you want to have a, I'm not doing this research, but I think this is a great research project. Like, how? It's the same, it's the demographic household survey, right? They're running the same survey. Huge drop. I mean, that's great. Like, it falls from 40% to 30%, right? So, I don't know, like, something is happening in terms of women's exposure to violence, that they are less exposed to violence than they were in the past. Now, if you look at the data, you know, I'm sure you're gonna see differences by demographic groups. It may have fallen more, in certain contexts than others. But the question of, I think one of the questions you're asking is, what should we do? Right? Like, you're coming from the policy school. So what should be done? Well, so something is happening already, is what I'm telling you. I don't know why, like why women are less at risk. That wasn't my project. But if I were to recommend, okay, what can be done given what I found, right? I would say my main questions don't actually have to do with women's exposure to risk, but have to do with their abilities to access justice, right? And so there, the question of what should we do to actually make things easier for them, I do think this is probably going to be an unpopular response for me, right, given this crowd. But in this context, not in the US, I want to be very clear, right? Not in the US, but in India, I think one thing that would really help is to have more people in these institutions, to pay them better, right? To have more cops, to actually give them a decent wage, to have more judges. So that we're not facing a situation where 26% of, you know, like court appointments are vacant. That is the situation we're facing in India. It means that it's impossible to actually access justice, right? The other thing is, I do think we need to have attitudinal changes, right? And how do you do that? Through trainings, et cetera, but also by having more women who are in these spaces, right? Like, I can tell you, I think the entire Indian police force, 8% of them are women. I mean, that's like a very easy thing to do, just like, and we do have comparative cases in places like Brazil, where they have, and I live in Montreal right now, 50% of cops have to be women in Quebec, right? Since 1972. And it's made a massive difference when you're working with women, like these things actually have concrete effects. So there's things that we can do to criminal justice institutions to make them more amenable to underprivileged people, including to women facing violence. So I would say let's start there. But the other thing is to think about what allows women to escape violent situations, right? And there, I think there's a whole other set of things that we could be doing. And one, the primary thing is that it's impossible to live alone as a woman in India. Some of you who are from there may know this, right? So to get to a situation where marriage is not compulsory, heterosexual marriage is not compulsory. It is completely mandatory and compulsory right now. That doesn't help anybody, right? To get to a place where women actually have jobs of their own. Women's workforce participation rates in India are some of, like they've always been one of the lowest in the world. It's dropped 10 percentage points in the last like 12 years, I believe. So it's now one of the lowest. So it, when you think about, okay, how can I survive outside of this abusive situation? You can't survive if you don't have money, right? So I would say these would be my go-to places. How you actually achieve those is another situation. Because there's massive political barriers on the one hand. Nobody actually wants police reform in India, right? It's useful for politicians to have police in their pockets. So, yeah, those would be my go-to, but I don't know. Let's see who can achieve them.
Okay, I want to thank you all very much for coming and for a really great set of questions. And I want to thank Falami for her talk and for the discussion and for speaking so openly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.